Hi, this is Brad Gillis from Night Ranger, and you're listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast right here. Enjoy.
Welcome to our July show at a time when hopefully many of you will be getting ready for or recovering from your summer gig experiences. We'll have the lowdown on who you can see live this month, as well as a full news and new release roundup. First up on the Classic Rock and Metal podcast couch, we speak to Brad Gillis from West Coast favourites Night Ranger, who have a new album reminiscent of those heady summers of old and believe that their good times may be back, albeit with conditions attached.
Jack did an interview in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have a psychic lady that comes on. And she goes, I see you charting top 30s with one of your singles off the new CD. Also, I see a little problem in your love life for about a month.
Simon Wright, former AC/DC and Dio drummer, talks about the current Dio Disciples tour and makes sure no one gets the wrong idea about what it is they're doing.
We're never, ever, ever, ever going to replace Ronnie. I mean, there's only ever one Ronnie James Dio.
And former member of Kiss guitarist Ace Frehley's band and renowned solo artist and producer Richie Scarlett talks about the fact that once you're on the Kiss Army's radar, they'll follow you to the ends of the earth.
Kiss fans, I think, are the greatest fans in the world. They're the most dedicated fans. And so I'm fortunate to have, them in my corner, and they do constantly check in and they buy my CDs and stuff like that. And so I'm fortunate to be part of the, I guess if you want to call it the Kiss family,
Finally, with a hugely successful world tour in progress at the moment and two albums out recently, Whitesnake are everywhere at the moment, and David Coverdale talks about their Live at Donington 1990 release after this old chestnut. Where's the BBC? No one has to say.
everything we can, of course. This is before high def. The sound is great. You know, it's high, great. It's a digital sound. It's really cool. And it's packed with unseen footage, unseen photographs from the Slip of the Tongue Liquor and Poker World Tour, a behind-the-scenes documentary there. It's just a lot of fun. Live at Donington, 1990. It's featuring Steve Vai, Adrian Vandenberg, Rudy Sarzo, Tommy Aldridge, and my good self, David Coverdale, on vocals.
DC there talking about the recent release Whitesnake Live at Donington 1990, which came out on CD and DVD, as you heard, and really is worth having if you're anything like a fan of the band. It's great to still have these time capsules pop up from when festivals like Donington really were attracting the world's best. This album, of course, on the back of Whitesnake's new studio album Forevermore, which was released in March, both on the Frontiers label. I caught the band recently at Bournemouth in the UK, much to the amusement of many of our subscribers, as I revealed it was actually the first time I'd ever seen them. I think we all have a band that managed to sort of slip through the net gig-wise, and for me it was Whitesnake. There was always some reason I couldn't get to see them. Anyway, that ghost was laid to rest along with a close-to-capacity arena down there. I was treated to a musical extravaganza, complete with the kind of double entendres that only David Coverdale can get away with these days.
Classic rock and metal news.
It's been an extraordinary month for Kiss's Gene Simmons, with first a toe-curling interview on the Today Show in the US, when sat alongside his long-term partner Shannon Tweed, he was trying to defend what seemed to be the latest in a long line of infidelities. But Tweed was having none of it and seemed to be indicating that the whole relationship was over, claiming it was unravelling. A few days afterwards, he was on CBS's The Talk, along with Sharon Osbourne, who took the opportunity to quiz him on his alleged comments about Ozzy and their children. And after being forced to remove his sunglasses, he then apologised for the remarks, although he claimed not to remember making them. And in reference to the aforementioned spat with Tweed, he claimed he'd do anything to finally grow up and be a man. And if that wasn't enough, footage from his reality show Gene Simmons' Family Jewels has shown him visiting the grave of his estranged father in Israel during his first visit there since leaving as a child. His father abandoned Simmons and his mother and remarried several times, leading to a lifelong obsession from him to succeed without his father's help. They never made amends, and an extraordinary clip shows the normally composed and incredibly self-confident Simmons tearful and racked with guilt that he'd never swallowed his pride and made peace. All three of those clips are available in our show notes, and if you're used to Gene's normally unshakable demeanour, they're certainly worth a look. Now, for those of you who don't know, Richie Blackmore isn't in Deep Purple anymore, having finally left in 1993, and since 1994, Steve Morse has been charged with guitar duties. But the interesting fact about all this is that this is Morse's 17th year with Purple, whereas in two stints with the band, Blackmore was only there for 16. Not that that'll make a hoot of difference to a lot of people out there, but it's interesting nonetheless. Apparently Vince Neil is to be honoured with a Lifetime Achievement in Rock and Roll Award by the magazine Vegas Rocks. This is Vince Neil, twice convicted of drinking and driving, once resulting in the death of Hanoi Rocks drummer Rassel, by the way. But hey, you can't rock and roll without raising hell, some would say, and although I'm not sure that singing in an admittedly above average band for a long time, even though the other members don't speak to you much anymore, is reason enough for a Lifetime Achievement Award, the magazine's publisher, Sally Steele, has other ideas. Vince has done so much over the years for charity since he's lived here in Las Vegas, and done so many events that has made this town buzz with excitement. It is especially a thrill to me personally to present this award to Vince, since I started this publication 7 years ago to honour and glorify my favourite band, Motley Crue. No hidden agenda there then, she went on to say in her perfect grammar. We're also planning on having a special secret guest present Vince's award to him with me, so stay tuned. Duff McKagan, who we featured in last month's show, has told how he lost his innocence at Donington in 1988 when two fans were killed during Guns N' Roses' set. He said he called home and cried on the phone when he found out what had happened. I remember that day well, and it wasn't until I got home that I learnt that two people had actually died. At the time, it just felt like the worst crowd surge I'd ever experienced. By contrast, in the creating life business is Scott Ian from Anthrax, who was forced to miss some shows, including a couple with the Big Four, Metallica, Anthrax, Slayer and Megadeth, because of the birth of his son, Revel Young Ian, in Los Angeles. Following on from last month's bizarre story about former Kiss guitarist Vinnie Vincent being charged with aggravated domestic assault on his wife, it appears he's reached a deal with the court which allows him to return to the family property as long as he lives in a different building and only visits the main house if his wife isn't there. He also has to undergo some anger management therapy. Night Ranger is a San Francisco band which epitomizes California sunshine and summer fun. In the 80s, they released 5 killer albums and a bunch of hit singles, the best known being Sister Christian, which stayed on the Billboard chart for 24 weeks. Another standout moment was the title theme to the Michael J. Fox movie The Secret of My Success. Since the early 90s, there have been many different lineups, with frontman Jack Blades forming an alliance with Ted Nugent in the band Damn Yankees before rejoining Night Ranger in 1996. Their 2007 release, Hole in the Sun, had mixed reviews, so their brand new album, Somewhere in California, has a lot riding on it. I spoke to guitarist and founder member Brad Gillis after a truly phenomenal show in London this month, astonishingly their first on these shores for 26 years. I expressed my admiration for their live exuberance and marvelled at his infectious enthusiasm after all this time.
We're so happy because we got a new record. We're real excited about the record. It's got great reviews. We're digging that. We're touring with Journey and Foreigner, you know. We're coming back to the States here in a couple weeks and doing 60 more shows in the States. It's the biggest year we've had since 1985. And, you know, Night Ranger has never been a band to sit around and just go through the motions. You know, we got Jack Blades running around like a crazy monkey up there, you know, and just can't stop, you know, and Joel flicking his hair around like a you know, rabid lion, you know. And it's just great for me to see him getting the respect that he deserves, because Joel is a fantastic player. He's my best buddy, my partner in crime. We hang all the time, and it's just great to know that everything's coming together, everybody's getting along, and it's exuding to the crowd. You know, I'm just so glad with the new record he can get away from our ex-guitar player Jeff Watson's shoes and shine on his own with this new CD. And he's such a great player that he actually kicked me in the butt doing this record, and I actually sat down and practiced, you know, and I actually, you know, worked on, you know, scales and runs and stuff, you know, because, you know, he had a lot to offer, and I needed to complement those, you know, the harmonies. And we, you know, he'd come in with something, I said, well, I'm gonna have to learn that harmony to that. You know, we sit down, we work it out, and I think this is the first time in a long time that I actually, him and I sit down before we go on stage and go through all these harmonies and stuff.
Well, it's amazing because that new material just seems to slot right in the show and next to the old classics, and they went down almost as well as the old stuff.
Yes, well, we tried to get back to the old original sound and vibe of the first 3 records, Dawn Patrol, Midnight Madness, and 7 Wishes, because that's where all of our big hits were, and that's where the formula was derived. So we intentionally went back to getting the big vocal harmonies, twin guitar assault, not tuning down, you know, sticking to regular pitch, but we approached it with more excitement. So that's why like 8 out of the 11 tunes on the record are up-tempo. We were all excited in the studio.
I think one of you guys said, I mean, it's power chords, there's dueling guitars, there's catchy choruses, great melodies, and feel-good lyrics. It's like it's a slice of heaven for people that, you know, that really love the old stuff.
Yeah, you know, and the big thing about the 80s, too, is everyone say, hey, man, you know, we love putting down the top of the rag top down in my car and driving down the streets cranking Night Ranger, you know? And we thought, well, hey, we're going to release for the summer, and we want to capture that same vibe again. Good time, feel-good music. You know, that's what it's all about. For our music being so up-tempo, there's more energy there, too. And it gets people excited, you know. So it's an adrenaline rush, you know. It was an adrenaline rush for us to record it, for us to play it, and hopefully for people to listen to it. Like I said, we're all very excited, and it's like, you know, being back in the 80s again for us.
Are we seeing a return to that rock being fun? Because we've had years of kind of suicidal doom and gloom metal, but there seems to be now a real appetite for this. Well, hang on a minute. Shouldn't we be having a smile on our face while we're listening to this?
Well, I think that, you know, with everything going on with the economy and stuff going on here and there, that, you know, people want something positive to relate to and to put a smile on their face. You know, when we went to Japan, you know, we could have canceled. You know, a lot of bands canceled, you know, after the great tragedy over there. You know, they got hit with a triple whammy over there. And the Mr. Udo, our promoter over there, who's a great man, you know, said, no, everything's good. It's safe to come over. You know, we need you over here. You know, your fans need you. And so we went over there with the premise of, hey man, you know, with all the everything going on, we want to know we can go over there and put a smile on these people's faces for 2 hours and they could just forget any problems they have and just go in and then just have a great time. And man, Japan was amazing. It was just amazing. You could see it in the faces and some people, you know, before the shows, and people talk and tell stories and stuff. But when it came down to the show, we were just glad to put these smiles on people's faces.
In the press kit, I think that I saw, we talked about it today as well, about the old sound, which you now is now like you're calling the new sound. You're like a lot of bands that are bringing out new material, which is easily as good or better than the stuff that people remember them for. And people are absolutely going crazy for it. Do you know, is there a reason for that, or is it just...
I think there's a resurgence of the 80s. I think there's a resurgence of the good time music that makes people feel good, you know? And what we're seeing on the pre-sale of the Journey Foreigner tour, Night Ranger tour, the 60 shows we're doing, we got a list of all the pre-sale numbers, and some of these shows are already sold out, 12, 14,000 people. And how exciting is that? You know, 2 months in advance of the show that we're sold out, or you know, Journey and Foreigner have sold it out, and we're lucky to tag along, you know. And the good thing is, you know, Journey's got their record out, and you know that's doing well. We got our new CD out, and Foreigner, I'll tell you, man, them live, they're kicking butt, man. They're sounding great. Journey sounds great. It's just, you know, everybody's on the top of their game right now, and there's a reason for it, because everybody wants to see it. Everybody's wants to get that feeling back again. And I think you're going to see a resurgence of all this music. And, you know, maybe some people, wouldn't it be great to have a Night Ranger single chart on Billboard again, you know? And it's just been released, so who knows what'll happen. But Jack did an interview in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have a psychic lady that comes on at the Bone radio station. And she comes in every Wednesday, and Jack did this Wednesday morning phoner in the station. And after talking about the record and then playing the single and everything, they said, hey, Jack, we have the psychic here. You know, you want to talk to her? And Jack goes, okay, you know. And she goes, well, Jack, I see you charting top 30s with one of your singles off the new CD. And Jack goes, really? Yeah. Then she goes, also, I see a little problem in your love life for about a month. And I was going, geez, oh great, she had to throw a thorn in there somewhere, right? And Jack has been happily married for 35 years, right? So I don't know if we've yet to see the thorn. But
on terms of the bands themselves, Frontiers as a label, they seem to be, I mean, they've got a great roster, and they seem to be allowing artists the freedom to create. Did you find that?
Yeah, it seems like they're the cutting edge of the resurgence of 80s music right now. You know, they got Def Leppard in there now, Journey and us and all these other bands. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing that they're able to come out and let these great records come out. You know, we signed the deal with them for, you know, basically the world except for Japan. We have King Records in Japan, but, you know, they came in big time for us. And, you know, released Japan a month ago, Europe here a couple weeks ago, America last week, and we're starting to get all the feedback now.
I mean, obviously, it's a stark contrast because freedom from the label and a relaxing relationship with the label wasn't always the story for Night Ranger, was it?
No, it was not. In fact, it was screwed up for us, man, you know. We came out with a bang with Don't Tell Me Love Me, you know, and then we released Sing Me Away, which did fair, but then the second record we came out with Still Rockin' America, boom, all over MTV. We were just kicking butt, and all of a sudden we saved Sister Christian for the second record, knowing that we wanted to get past, you know, a freshman and sophomore release, because the, you know, band's usual stay in this industry is only a couple years, you know, and we wanted longevity, and the record company said, hey man, save Sister Christian, we'll release it second on the second record, boom, on the top five on the charts, it was up there for 26 weeks, kicking butt, and it was a staple of Night Ranger's, of our career, you know, that song is like, you know, Night Ranger's biggest hit ever, and I'll never forget in 1984 pulling into La Crosse, Wisconsin, and we were playing a Coliseum there, and we pulled in the bus and looked up at the marquee and said, Night Ranger sold out, 8,000 people. And that was a pinnacle for our career. Oh my gosh, we're headlining, we're sold out. Then we had our great run from, you know, 84 to like 89.
It's an interesting question though, and I ask it a lot of bands where songs, whereas as huge as that, could be both a blessing and a curse. Was there any of that for that, you know, where...
Well, to get back to your question about the record company, so we did release Sister Christian, and it was such a big hit, they figured, hey, man, well, this band is a power ballad band, let's keep releasing them. And they just kept releasing ballad after ballad. We kept doing the videos, you know, and all these ballads. And then when we did release something up-tempo, it was Secret of My Success, which was a turn for us, you know. And at that point, it already started to dwindle, and we couldn't get back to our rock roots.
So, Growing Up in California, the single, great track, just right for the summer, fairly self-explanatory, but talk us through it anyway.
Yeah, I tell you, Jack wrote that song for his solo record. Jack goes, hey man, I want you to play my record, man. I said, okay. And he played that song and wanted me to play on it, right? And I heard it, I said, Jack, it's a Night Ranger tune. He goes, really? I go, dude, come on, you're talking about us in there. And we kind of redid it our way, and it ended up being the lead track off of the record.
Raised inside the American
catch them live this month.
Okay, well, as promised, we have a rundown of some of the bands you can see live in July, so here goes. The Choir Boys have a couple of UK dates in July and August. Black Country Communion, the Glenn Hughes, Joe Bonamassa, Jason Bonham and Derek Sherillian project have got five UK dates to support their second album, and you can also see them at the High Voltage Festival. More about that in a moment. Chicago are playing a one-off show at the Hammersmith Apollo in London on the 6th of July, so be quick for that one. And Yes and Styx have a co-headline tour kicking off in the US on the 4th of July and running through to early August. US Southern Rock legends Blackfoot have a handful of UK dates in July, plus a couple stateside in August and September. Our friends Europe have an 8-date tour booked in their homeland of Sweden, but you lot probably already knew that, didn't you? Deep Purple, who we mentioned earlier, are out on tour at the moment, and you can still catch them in Europe during most of July. Dream Theatre, now without founder member Mike Portnoy on drums, of course, are playing the UK on the 22nd of the 23rd of July. This, of course, just before their Sunday headlining slot at the High Voltage Festival. And as we've mentioned it twice, let's do the full spiel on that. The festival is in its second year now in the UK. Classic rock in orientation. It's going to be at Victoria Park in London again. It's the 23rd and 24th of July. And on those 2 days, you can see Judas Priest, Slash, Thin Lizzy, Queensryche, Michael Monroe, Skin, Dream Theatre, Black Country Communion, Thunder, Michael Schenker, Jethro Tull, and Barclay James Harvest, plus a host of others. Priest, of course, are reportedly on their last world tour and are also playing arenas in the UK in early July too, and supported by Queensryche. The Black Crowes are in Manchester and London from the 11th to the 13th of July. And just in case you've been asleep all year, Iron Maiden are playing 10 arena dates in the UK between July the 20th and August the 5th. Finally, Tokyo Blade headline the Power of the Night Festival in Cyprus on the 17th of July and play Headbangers Open Air in Germany on the 28th. Anvil are in London on the 11th. Slash has a few UK dates, including that homecoming show in Stoke-on-Trent. But the diehards will no doubt be heading for what is now the mother of all festivals, the mighty Sonisphere at Nebworth in Hertfordshire, where you can, of course, see the Big Four of Thrash, Metallica, Anthrax, Megadeth and Slayer on the same stage in the UK for the first time, plus around 10,000 other bands over the 3 days. And that starts on July the 8th. Simon Wright is a fellow Mancunian, and having paid his dues with a few bands up north, he was catapulted to superstardom by becoming AC/DC's Styx man, replacing Phil Rudd in 1983 and recording 3 albums, Fly on the Wall, Who Made Who and Blow Up Your Video. He left in 1989 to join Dio, and apart from the hiatus when Ronnie went back to Sabbath for the Dehumanizer album, remained a member of the band and close friend until Dio's death last year. Recently, he, along with the remaining Dio band and singers Toby Jebson and Tim Ripper Owens, have taken to the road as the Dio Disciples, playing a set of songs made famous by the man himself. They've come under some flack early on, but not from the fans, who seem to get right away what they were trying to do, as Simon himself explains.
All we're trying to do here is celebrate, you know, and keep his music, like I said, alive for his fans. You know, we were expecting some people might misconstrue what we're doing, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're just fans. And especially me, Scott and Craig, you know, we're his family. So it's like when a family member passes away, you don't just forget about it, you know, you always remember. Mm. And we want to honour him. It's as simple as that. It's like, you know, when a soldier dies or something like that, you know, it's commemorating and stuff, and you never forget. And people have seen what we're doing, and that's all we're doing. And they seem to like what we're doing. You know, we're still a good band, so we really just want to keep going on. And I'm hoping people come around, at least give it a chance and see what we're doing. It's all good, you know.
I mean, obviously, when great songs are written, in many ways, it doesn't matter who sings or plays them. And it got, you know, Tim Ripper Owens and Toby Jebson. I think Doro's going to be doing a couple of shows. It kind of doesn't matter who sings or plays them. They're still great songs, and they need to be heard.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, we're never, ever, ever, ever going to replace Ronnie. I mean, there's only ever one Ronnie James Dio, and everybody knows that. So, you know, and you're exactly right. I mean, the songs stand for themselves. I mean, they're epics, you know, and they're down in history. So one of the points we wanted to try and make, the fact that there'll never be another Ronnie, was that we didn't want to bring in somebody who was just like him, because that would be sort of like a tribute band kind of thing, and we're not a tribute band. I mean, we were his band, and all, and we don't want somebody up there who's trying to be and look and sound exactly like Ronnie. We want, you know, great singers to come in, you know, and be themselves and stuff, you know, and it just seems to make more sense that way, because you'll never replace Ronnie.
Obviously the set list must have been a little tricky to pick. Did you all chuck names in a hat, or how did it work?
Well, we had to do that. You've got to do the hits. You've got to do those most memorable favourite songs, you know, like Heaven and Hell, Where You Are, Rainbow in the Dark, Neon Nights, and Holy Diver. So we sort of work around those ones, you know. We've got to do those ones, which is great, you know, playing those songs even still now, you know. But we wanted to get rolling too, you know. We wanted to get on the road and see how we were going to be and do and stuff like that. So I think as we progress and stuff, we're going to start throwing in some of the older songs too, and maybe songs that haven't been done before, or maybe songs that were done but they haven't been done in a long time and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's gonna get very interesting, you know, for not only for us but for the fans as well, you know. We always pay attention, you know, to what the fans are comments and stuff like that, you know, what they're like and what they're thinking as well. So it's you know, it's going to be an interesting time for everyone.
I was going to say, because whenever I'd see Ronnie, whenever Heaven and Hell would come in, you could, I don't know, maybe it was just me, but you could almost see that it was kind of, he was, you know, he was loving that particular song, and it could go on forever as far as he was concerned, it seemed like, and for everyone else as well.
Yeah, Heaven and Hell is a definite staple. It's a brilliant song. I remember hearing that on the radio, and it was for the first time way back when, and it was like, wow, what is this? This is amazing, you know. It was like, this is, I mean, you know, Ronnie had a way, I think, of really breaking ground. You know, he did it in Rainbow, he did it in Black Sabbath, he did it in his own band, in Dio. You know, he really created special things that will live on forever. And I think he really did used to love singing Heaven and Hell. That was, you know, definitely one of his favourites, I think. And it's one of ours as well. You know, it's killer playing that live.
Well, also, the thing is, that's one of those classic examples of a song where you can listen to it on vinyl, that's great, but that song has taken on a life of its own when played live, and it would be criminal if that stopped, you know?
Exactly. You know, I mean, to never see, you know, you can see bands who play it and stuff like that, and here and there, but I mean, it's like, you can't let a song like that just, you know, never be seen being played live again. I mean, it's like, it's just such an anthem.
I never actually got the full story on how the AC/DC gig came about.
I answered the hat, you know, drummer wanted, and if you don't hit hard, don't apply. Went down the audition, I had no money and stuff, and the band weren't there, it was just the drum tech. So played the three tracks, I think it was Black Dog, Shoot the Thrill, and Tush. So went through those, finished up, and drum tech said, yeah, great, we'll be. So I thought, oh, you know, fine, whatever. And 3 hours later, the phone rang, and it was him. And he's, I walk in, and the drum tech's there. He's like, Dickie Jones. He later went on to be my drum tech for about 8 years, you know.
Right.
You know, he says, hey, come with me. So we're down the corridor, and it's in a different part of the rehearsal building, and there's all these flight cases, AC/DC on them, and I'm like, oh, shit, no way. You're kidding. Walking down, they open the door, and they're all sitting there. Said hello and all that. You know, sat down. Right, what are we going to do then? That was basically it. Yeah, we sat down, we started playing. We ran through, like, Hell's Bells, Let There Be Rock, All Lot of Rosie, Back in Black, and all that stuff. And we stopped for a bit, and then they started talking about the start of the North American tour and all this lot. And I'm like, this must mean I'm in the band then. You know, it's like...
Blimey.
And things went on from there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, God, 8 years. I mean, I think I heard you talking about AC/DC. Obviously, it's one of the biggest gigs anyone's ever going to get. But, I mean, it must have been great, but I think bad as well. I mean, what was the best and the worst thing about being with them? Because it must have been, you must have had both sides of it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, the best, it was, you know, the crowds and stuff like that. I mean, it was just unbelievable. When those lights went down, you walked on that stage, it was like you were deafened. I mean, it was so freaking loud. Great fans. I mean, we used to do that song, The Jack, they, you know, the sing-along bit in the middle is just different, you know. It's unbelievable. I mean, I was very young when I got in that band. I wish I'd have been a bit older when I got in that band, you know, because there was a lot of stuff I started to get worried about, you know. It was like, you know, being away from home for so long. I mean, you're talking about 8, 9, 10 month tours. It's like unbelievable. I mean, it was good. I mean, good. I mean, it's unbelievable experience. You know, it's something that I'll obviously never forget. You know, and they were great to me. You know, because I was a bit young and stuff like that. And they threw it all the madness of everything and stuff like that. They're great guys. And yeah, I think it was just, you know, the shock of being away for so long. You know, you get used to it after a while. You're very comfortable, obviously, but, yeah.
It's funny because they obviously disappeared for quite a while, and now, having come back, it's like, it seems like they could fill any stadium in the world.
It seems that. It seems that way, doesn't it? Yeah. Play anywhere. Yeah. Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, those songs are classics, and, you know, they'll go. Those songs will go down in history. You know,
I think Tora Tora was your first band, wasn't it? How old were you then?
Yeah. How old was I?
Yeah.
I think I was 15, 16, something like that.
And then, well, there was a couple, but I think A to Z is probably the one that people who go back a ways would remember. But I think you only did they did a live album. But the thing was, it only the 12-inch that you played on?
It was, no, it wasn't. I didn't play on that 12-inch. I just did the 40. It was like a 45, a Russ Ballard song. Russ Ballard had been doing a lot of the Rainbow hits, writing for Richie Blackmore. The record company came up with this song from him that they thought would be sort of good for us to do, and it was a good song. You know, it was a bit more poppy and stuff, but. I think it was called I'm the One Who Loves You or something. Yeah.
Well remembered, it was indeed called I'm the One Who Loves You, and if you've never heard it, it goes like this.
Too long.
Richie Scarlett has been kicking around the New York rock and roll scene for a good while. If you've listened to any amount of music in the last 20 years, the chances are you've either heard him play or listened to something he's produced. Although I already knew him as former Kiss guitarist Ace Frehley's solo band member, he cropped up more recently as one of the fabulous Fifth Avenue Vampires, the band which also includes original Alice Cooper band member, Hall of Famer and all-round rock legend Dennis Dunaway. With an album out last year and always a good yarn to spin, it was my pleasure to spend a few minutes in the company of the man affectionately known to many as the Emperor of Rock and Roll.
Well, before we kind of kick off, I recently saw a TV commercial that you did for the music store, the East Coast Sound, way back in 1980, which was...
Wow. That was my father. That wasn't me, man. No, I'm just kidding you, man. That was me.
What was the story behind that?
Well, that was the biggest music store at that time on the East Coast. It really was. And the guy that owned that store, Ed Roman, went on to start his own guitar company, and he's got a very successful business in Las Vegas. But it was funny because I was taking acting lessons at the time in New York, and the teacher hated me because I came in late and he didn't know anything about me. And about 3 weeks into the lessons, it was once a week, he said to me, "Hey, you know, I turned my TV on to watch Star Trek, and I see you on the fucking TV doing a commercial, man." And because it used to come on right after Star Trek, the first commercial.
The other thing that I saw is that, obviously, you see it because everybody refers to you as the Emperor of Rock and Roll, and I can't quite remember where that started either.
Well, you know, I don't take that seriously. That's just somebody had said one day, "Hey, man, Elvis was the king, man. You know, you're the emperor." And, you know, I've had fun with it. And it's amazing how that spread all over the world. I mean, kind of a joke, really. But I look at it, too, that so many people call me the emperor that I must have left some kind of mark with them. I don't know. I must have moved them in some way. But it's fun. It's fun. It's better than being called, you know, the asshole or rock or something. And, you know, the emperor is fine with me.
Well, listen, Fever is your latest solo album, which came out late 2010. Thanks for sending it, by the way. I love it. Are you pleased with it?
Yes, I am. I would have liked to. I had a couple other original tunes. I got really rushed to finish it, so I ended up doing the Alex Harvey song on there. It's a loud, rude, obnoxious rock and roll record, the way, you know, basically, you know, and I wrote a lot of those songs with that kind of attitude. Some of those songs go back to my Sex Pistol, Generation X, Damned kind of days, you know. But yeah, I'm happy with it. I'm glad you like it. I appreciate it.
I love that. But before I'd heard that, the album that I heard was the Fifth Avenue Vampires, which of course you're one of the vampires, along with Dennis Dunaway, you mentioned earlier on. And he was, I mean, we'll talk about the album, but he was obviously inducted. He was in the Hall of Fame with the Alice Cooper Band. I guess you were at the ceremony, right?
Yes, I was, and that was a great honor for me to see him. And I've been close with Michael Bruce and Neil Smith for 20 years, so, and Glenn, but Glenn's no longer with us. But to see them get in there, that was absolutely a thrill. You know, the whole night was a great night, you know. It really was. And to see them, you know, get inducted and get the recognition they deserved after all these years, it was absolutely a thrill.
It's funny, because when I spoke to him, he kind of corrected me. I wanted to know what you said about it as well, because I thought that both you and the Vampires have a sound which I think a lot of people would say is the 70s, but Dennis said, no, that's just kind of the way we play. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I would. I think he's pretty correct there, because we're all products of the 70s music from that era, and... you know, we didn't plan out to make it sound like that, but it was a different avenue for me to go down, playing kind of like a horror rock thing. You know, a lot of my solos, I tried to make kind of scary sounding and stuff. And so it was a different avenue for me to take.
Now listen, being a huge Kiss fan, obviously I heard you on Ace's album, Trouble Walking. How did you originally hook up with Ace?
I had met Ace through a guy named Eddie Solon, and Eddie Solon was the Kiss's original sound man way back. And I was doing my first record, which was called Hit for Hit, and I needed a 12-string, and he said, "Well, let me call Ace Frehley." You know, I said, "This guy's going to let me borrow a guitar. He doesn't even know me, you know." So we went up to his mansion in Connecticut, and they were looking for a guitar player at that point. He had just left Kiss, and next thing you knew, I ended up in his band. So it all happened fast, and I worked with him for a while. We did the first tour together, and then I left because things got really slow and things weren't happening. And so he got Todd Howorth, and then that didn't work out for him. or as fans, I guess. So I ended up coming back with him and doing that Trouble walking record, and I stayed with him from 89 till he went back to Kiss in 96. And we toured all over the place and just had a blast, man. And I'm still waiting for the new Peter Criss record, which I did almost 2 years ago. That should be coming out on Sony this year sometime, they tell me. And I love Peter, and I've been very close to Peter for many years. And
do you find it odd that playing with just former members of Kiss kind of enters you into this club, which means that you'll be special guest of honor at Kiss Expos, and fans will kind of go out of their way to find out what you're up to?
Well, it's absolutely, you know, I'm lucky that I was able to at least be accepted by Ace's fans. You know, like I said, Todd Howarth didn't go over too well with his fans, but fortunately, they seemed to like me. And when I first went on my solo mission, released my first CD, Wise Guy from New York, I kind of tried to, you know, remove myself from the Kiss thing, and it's impossible to do. And then I realized, you know, their fan base, they're just too, they're like bigger than life, you know. So at first it was a little bit, you know, a tag. I wanted to just be recognized just for myself, actually. But then I embraced it, and, you know, realizing that it is a fan base that, you know, it's just so huge. And Kiss fans, I think, are the greatest fans in the world. They're the most dedicated fans of any band that I know. And so I'm fortunate to have, you know, them in my corner, you know. And they do constantly check in, and they buy my CDs and stuff like that. And so I'm fortunate to be part of it, I guess, if you want to call it the Kiss family, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, you make a good point, because, I mean, it was just a part of you know, a long career of stuff that you've done. I mean, you've worked with so many people. I mean, Leslie West and Sebastian Bach, Noel Redding from the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh, that was incredible to play with Noel Redding, because I am the biggest Hendrix freak that I know. He was such a gentleman, and, you know, it was just a great honor. I also got to play on Corky Lang's last CD, which was the last record that Noel ever played on. It's called Out There is the name of the CD. And so I look at the credits and I see, you know, Richie the Emperor Scarlet guitar, Noel Redding bass, and it freaks me out, because, I mean, as a kid, you know, the Jimi Hendrix Experience was, you know, that's actually before Alice Cooper. I was a little kid, and bang, man, there it was, you know. So it's always a great thrill to get the respect from people that I grew up as a kid listening to and buying their records, and then the next thing you know, you're actually playing with them.
A lot of people say if you remember Woodstock, then when you weren't really there, but you've done it twice, haven't you? You were there originally and for the anniversary.
I was actually there. I was I really was there. You know, back then everybody said they were there. You know, and all I'd have to say was, man, Jeff Beck was great, right? And they go, oh, he was dynamite. And I go, he didn't even play. You know, he was on the bill to play, but I actually was there. My mother drove me there. Left me off with my neighbor about a mile from the site. I actually was a sucker who had bought a ticket. I was 14, and I was there for 3-4 days. And I sat down, Oliver, and I was in the very last row. I think Richie Havens was playing. There was nobody behind me. It was still daylight. I'm this 14-year-old kid. And it got dark, and about an hour, 2 hours later, whenever it was, I stood up to stretch out, and I turned around, and it was just a sea of people had come and sat down behind me, where I was in the last row at the time, and it was just an incredible, incredible experience. And Monday morning, when Jimi Hendrix came on, like I'd say at least 60% of the people were gone. I had been up for days. That's why my mother let me go. And I ran up there, and I saw Jimmy watching Sha Na Na, who was performing, who did not fit the bill at all. But he was standing there watching him, and I just ran up, and I went, Jimmy, Jimmy! And he looked at me, and he just pointed at me. And I've been under his spell ever since.
And from Richie's excellent solo album, Fever, released last year, this is his pick, Radio Dreams.
Transistor, clutch to my ear. It was past my bedtime, but I just had to hear. 'Cause it blew.
little kid with radio dreams.
We're catching up a bit, but here's some of the stuff out recently that you should be aware of. Alice Cooper released the Old School box set covering the years 1964 to 74 and was compiled under the guidance of producer Bob Ezrin. It includes demos, a complete live show, 64-page book, a DVD, some vinyl, all sorts of goodies, and for a mere $260 you can own one. Black Country Communion, who we mentioned earlier, released their second album, sensibly titled 2. The infamous 1979 AC/DC concert, filmed and released as the Let There Be Rock documentary, has finally made it to DVD and is available now. Roger Glover, Deep Purple's bass player and renowned producer, has a solo album out this month called If Life Was Easy. and Phoenix Rising, which is a two-hour documentary with live footage on Deep Purple during Japan's tour with Tommy Bolin in 1976, recounts the band in turmoil before they split shortly afterwards. The month has a J in it, so it's time for an Iron Maiden compilation. From Fear to Eternity is out on multiple formats and includes the best of the years 1990 to 2010. No, it's a double album, not an EP, so don't be cheeky. Eagle Rock have a double DVD from Twisted Sister coming out at the end of July, and charts live performances from the North Stage Theatre back in 1982 right up to 2001's Steel Benefit show. And George Lynch, former Dokken and Lynch Mob guitar whiz, has a solo album out called Kill All Control. Cherry Red have two interesting releases this month. First, a reissue of David Bowie guitarist Mick Ronson's solo album, Heaven and Hell, which features guest performances from Bowie himself, Chrissie Hynde, Phil Collins, Brian May and John Mellencamp. And second is a two-disc singles compilation from Terraplane. Terraplane, if you remember, morphed into the band Thunder after a couple of years and of having very publicly called it quits last year. They dumbfounded the music world, not by appearing at this year's High Voltage Festival. Anyway, it's a great compilation with all the good stuff and some horrifying remixes too. There's just time to bid you a fond farewell for July and have a good one until we reconvene on August the 1st for the next show. I'll leave you with a band from Sweden who've just released their second album called Diamonds. You'll be hearing a lot more about them, mostly from me, and if you listen really hard you might pick up the occasional 80s influence. This is the brilliant Enforcer with Live for the Night.